You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the U.S. forces move into the major cities of Iraq, the stories increase of U.S. soldiers firing upon unarmed civilians. Yesterday, reports emerged of soldiers opening fire on a shopkeeper as he tried to defend his property from looters. But many mainstream media outlets have chosen to limit the pictures they show of Iraq's dead and dying. Santa Rosa, California, physician Dr. April Hurley went to Iraq as part of a peacekeeping team of the humanitarian group Voices in the Wilderness to bear witness to the results of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Peace Watch spoke to Hurley yesterday regarding what motivated her to go to Iraq and why she remained even after the bombing began. Hurley related how over 50% of the residents of Baghdad are children under 15 years old. Today we continue with part two of our interview as Hurley relates the conditions of the healthcare system in Baghdad. We reached her in Amman, Jordan.
What we were doing was going to the hospitals and talking to victims and victims' families and letting them vent to an American face, which was a big help. It was even a help for nurses and doctors to see an American face that they could talk to, and they weren't preaching to the choir. They were preaching to an American who was from the aggressor country. Many of us were American. Some of us were Korean, Canadian, Australian, Belgium, you know, we were from all different countries. But basically, we were there to witness the victims' agony and fears and talk to families. But we were noticing more and more that there just was too many civilians and too many civilians in areas far from military targets. Some of them had even gone to the outskirts of the city to join family members where they thought they'd be safe, on dairy farms or on, you know, ranches outside the city.
Is it possible these were locations that were somehow in proximity-wise adjacent to or close to so-called military targets?
Maybe some of them were, but the ones that we saw, many of them were not. And it didn't matter. You know, when people are that close to military targets, which is a dense city like Baghdad, where people are in neighborhoods that are surrounding ministry offices that were military targets, telephone communication buildings that were military targets. They shouldn't be, but they were. Electrical stations that were military targets. Those shouldn't be military targets. Those are civilian infrastructure, but they were military targets, and civilians were taken out just without consideration of how close they were. And we were finding that a lot, too. But there were also people being hit almost deliberately. People were saying that planes were flying overhead, and then there was a bomb that sounded like, it could sound like, from the description, like a cluster bomb in the midst of a bunch of farmhouses, and it took out some of them.
Now, when you
and
say
it killed kids.
When you say almost deliberately, that's kind of like being...
Almost, well, the stories we were getting were suggestive of deliberate strikes on civilians, and that's what we were very concerned about, and that's why we wrote our report.
Give me an example of one of those stories.
Well, one of the stories was that group of farmhouses that were in the middle of nowhere, because we did go to sites and look and say, what's around here? And there was nothing. And yet people tell us that something landed like a cylinder and then later exploded after cattle went up to it and kids went up to it. And it later exploded and it seemed to blow everybody away, including houses, and took out every cattle, you know, every livestock animal that they had, and kids and family. So it was that story. The civilians that I saw that had come from Syria on a bus included about three Syrian men and a couple Moroccans, and they had come in on a bus from Syria, and they were civilians, and with them were some Red Crescent workers and some Christians. These men happened to be Muslims, but there were other people on the bus as well. They were in civilian clothes. They could have been coming to help with the jihad or whatever reason, but they were civilians on this bus. This bus was followed by an Apache helicopter, and finally it was rocketed, and it was it was destroyed. Maybe 16 or 17 people were killed. The ones I saw in the hospital had been injured. Some of them, one or two were in that bus. A few were in the buses that followed that bus, and actually there was kind of like a rear-end collision where one bus ran into the first bus and another bus ran into that. So there was some pile-up there. But the first bus was destroyed. And on the way out of Baghdad on the 13th, when I came to Jordan, I saw that bus. And I saw the missile strikes at the road, and there's no question that that bus was struck deliberately by an Apache helicopter that had been trailing it. Mm. Now, they also say that the bus was hit after people climbed out of the bus and were identifiable as civilians, and the bus was hit again. And then when they were rescued and they were taken from the area, the bus was struck again. Mm.
At some point, the hospitals became so overwhelmed that Red Cross workers, other aid workers such as yourself, were not able to continue to do the type of work that you needed to do in terms of keeping count of the casualties that were coming into the hospital.
They're not well-staffed in terms of ancillary services. They're well-staffed with physicians. So I never did any physician work. I never was needed that way. And other doctors actually were around looking to be useful, but none of us were really very useful during the bombing because the doctors were there, and actually many doctors had come to Iraq who were raised in Iraq and gone to other countries, had come back to try to help. And other Arab-speaking doctors from other countries had come to help. So there were doctors there that could do what they needed to do. But keeping counts was not something they could spend a lot of time with, and they never had accurate counts for us. You know, if we asked them what was the casualty count at the market that was hit, they'd say 67 or 56, or they say 72. So we never got an accurate count. It didn't matter. It was a massacre, no matter what, you know, you saw. But we stopped asking for figures. It wasn't useful. And also, they really didn't have the staff to try to take care of those details. Mm. So they actually were very competent and very good and working with the stuff they had that was restricted due to sanctions. So they didn't have a lot of medications. They didn't have a lot of supplies that you should have in a hospital, but they were making do. For instance, IVs were running by gravity. There were no intravenous pumps. People on ventilator didn't really have a nurse standby. It was just the family at the bedside ready to alert a doctor that the person was looking poor, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there weren't enough nurses. So people that you'd see in intensive care units, they weren't intensive care units. They were on the floor with family hovering over them, watching. And basically, that worked very well. It's just that it's not good enough. But the doctors did very well, and they have a lot of experience with war casualties, and they would say that. They would say, you know, we're used to this. And what had happened, though, that was one phase of the hospital during the bombing. Another phase of the hospitals during the bombing was when the telephones went out. The telephones were systematically destroyed throughout the city, one at a time. And now, finally, the hospitals couldn't communicate with each other. People couldn't call in emergencies like 9/11 because they had a bombing nearby or they had casualties or somebody was in labor or somebody was having a heart attack. They couldn't call for an ambulance. So the ambulance sat at the hospital. You go to the hospital to see. We would make trips to the hospital, and these ambulances were sitting outside, just sitting there, because they couldn't be used. They could not be used. If somebody came to the hospital with some victim in the car and said, there's tons of other victims at the site, well, the people at the site were finding cars to take people to the hospital. By the time the ambulance would get there, the people were there having scavenged cars from the neighborhood that were functional, and they'd take the victims to the hospital themselves. And so, but still, you didn't have paramedics at the mm-hmm. scene. You didn't have emergency services. That was completely taken out by taking out the phones. And that was a deliberate civilian strike. So it became increasingly difficult to get around the city. So ambulances couldn't get around the city, and many ambulances were caught in the crossfire. And that's when the Red Cross pulled out, and that's when the Red Crescent was losing ambulances, getting hijacked and driven away and dismantled for parts. So there was all sorts of ways that the health system crashed, and people were left to die in the street, and bodies were piled up at mosques, and people were buried wherever they were, and bodies were burned that, you know, couldn't wait to be buried. So there was a whole lot of casualties, deaths, that are not accounted for. There's just no records.
Dr. April Hurley, a family physician from Santa Rosa, California, who was in Baghdad as part of the peacekeeping team of Voices in the Wilderness. As the U.S. military campaign against Iraq winds down, Iraqi civilians, particularly women and children, continue to bear the brunt of the attacks and the continuing economic sanctions. Dr. Curtis Dobler works with an international study team of independent academics, researchers, and practitioners examining the humanitarian effects of military conflict on the civilian population, particularly on the children. The team recently compiled a study entitled Our Common Responsibility, The Impact of a New War on Iraq. Children. Dr. Dobler spoke recently with Armando Gadinha of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
The home is a civilian object under international humanitarian law, and you cannot attack that. Whether or not a place is something that deserves the special protection I talked about during an armed conflict, you'd have to look at the particular context, and that's not always an easy decision to make, but there are some very clear cases that we've seen already even advertised by the various parties to this conflict that I think would contradict the protection that children deserve. And one classic example, days ago, the American forces showed themselves occupying a school with children in front of it, saying that they had taken over this school now, and that the school had, in fact, they claimed, been used by militants from Iraq to carry out attacks against them. Even if that is true, it was a violation then by the militants using it in Iraq or from the Iraqi army or other parts of Iraq. But it was also a violation by the American troops that were occupying it, particularly as they took the picture with children standing in front of it. That object could have been attacked by the Iraqi armed forces or any other armed forces that was participating in this armed conflict. And those children then could have been, of course, injured or killed in an attack. And that is an example of really abusing a civilian object that has particular relevance to children, in this case, a school.
War is bombs and fighting and bad things. And lots of people could get killed in war.
Well, this kind of war is when, like, a country fights with another country, or between one person and another person, or, like, a group of people and another.
The international law is not as easy as national law or not as clear as national law to prosecute offenders of that law and the forms in which offenders can be prosecuted. But there are a number of ways. For example, there are groups that are already involved in bringing a case to the Inter-American Commission against the United States, holding them responsible for actions that violated human rights more generally during the armed conflict. Those would also be humanitarian law. The United States, in fact, has an obligation under Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, common to all the Geneva Conventions. There are four of them, including the fourth one, which is most important for civilians. It says that they have an obligation to ensure that people who violate those conventions are punished. And under Article 149, or 147 and 149, there are other procedures that are available that require the United States to punish people who commit violations of that law. If they don't, it is a very difficult question still as to what can be done to force them to do that. But at least the legal regime exists where the obligations exist and where there are possibilities pointed out that can be used by the international community if they want to try to protect children using these conventions and law.
Prior to this most recent military invasion of Iraq, what was the state of children, and in particular, what laws, if any, were being protected and or violated by the existing regime? Do the sanctions imposed on Iraq in any way, shape, or form contribute to the violation of international rights for children?
Yes, I think those are very important questions. As you saw from our report, we showed that children right now in Iraq are probably more vulnerable, or were before the start of this current war, were more vulnerable than they were at any other time in the last 25 years or so in Iraq, or really probably at any time in Iraq's history, because Iraq had been gradually developing its infrastructure up until 1990 before the first, the 1990 Gulf War broke out. And so certainly the infrastructure and all had been at destroyed during that war, and during the sanctions, children were made even more vulnerable. So children right now are in Iraq at the time that this war started. We're in a very vulnerable situation, and part of that being this because of the sanctions. If you look at the reports of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Iraq, which had been several people during the last 12 years, those reports indicated that the Iraqi government was in part responsible for the violations of children's human rights. If you look at the reports, though, of other UN agencies, they indicated that the Iraqi government was doing everything possible under the circumstances to try to provide for the rights of individuals in Iraq, but that it was not able to do that because of sanctions. So you had two sort of conflicting views being expressed by UN bodies there, if you will, one by the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights blaming the Iraqi regime for not having protected human rights sufficiently within the country, but not really pointing out what it could have done more, essentially saying that it had merely that the rights were not being protected, and another one pointing out that the Iraqi regime, for example, had probably the most efficient food distribution system in the world functioning under sanctions, but that it was still not able to protect those rights even when it was doing everything possible, which then implicates, of course, the international community.
War is a fight between two parties to destroy the other part, or for freedom.
It's going to frighten you because they never knew what war was, so their parents had to tell them what war was. And, well, it's like other people fighting with other people, and they want to win something, and they really want to get other things that the other people want to get. And so that's how they fight to get something. So they wanted to fight to get oil.
I think one thing very important to look at is right now the United States and the United Kingdom, although they are denying this, they are, according to international humanitarian law, occupying large parts of Iraq. It is not an intention, as they have claimed, but it is a de facto determination. If you are in de facto control of an area, then you are occupying that area. And if you occupy that area, you become responsible under even the Geneva Conventions, which apply in time of war. You become responsible for providing adequate humanitarian assistance. You become responsible for providing health care. You become responsible for providing education. You become responsible for providing food to particularly children. And each one of these, if you were to look at our report on page 5, I think it was, you would see that each one of these things that I just named, although they're human rights, they are explicitly considered to be the responsibility of an occupying power. And I think that right now there needs to be a serious effort made, and I hope that it is made sooner rather than later, to try to protect children, at least for these basic rights. And as far as I can see at the moment, and I think this is a fairly common consensus among both aid agencies and the United Nations, this is not being done at the moment.
I was at school when the war started. I was doing my history. My teacher bring a radio with him so he could listen to the news.
And then he told us that the war started. I felt sad because I knew a lot of people were going to die.
Children are often, if you will, not even if the direct casualties of conflict, they are the long-term casualties of conflict. And I think that that's what that particular statement is aimed at, that if you were to look at the number of children that are killed in conflict, although the number of civilians has been more than soldiers during armed conflict, that where you really see the casualties of armed conflict is in the long term. And if you were to look at our report, you'll see that one of the most harrowing conclusions we drew is that the psychological impact of children, which will not be just one generation of children, but at least two or three generations of children to date, and now God knows how much longer after the current use of force, that psychological impact of armed conflict will last with society for many generations to come.
Dr. Curtis Dobler researches the humanitarian effects of military conflict on children. For the complete copy of his group's report entitled Our Common Responsibility, The Impact of a New War on Iraqi Children, go to www.warchild.ca. Dr. Dobler was interviewed by Armando Gardinia of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Special thanks also to Fidel Rodriguez for preparing that piece. Finally tonight, this segment of political satire from the Creative Unity Collective at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
Battle for the escape beneath the planet of Saddam. The Creative Unity pseudo-news War Desk Report. Here now your War Desk journalists, Yusuf Lamont, Daryl McNeil, and co-anchor, LaRonda Day.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Howdy, y'all.
We're here to bring you the latest from the war front in battleground Iraq. As you know, in our last program, we actually went to our embedded reporter. We also had LaRonda speak to an embedded with reporter. We spoke to Brigadier General Grief Dutz and various and sundry other military analysts for their take on the war at that point. Well, apparently, I guess the war is pretty much over, save for the shooting.
But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
And for that reason, we have opted not to pull our, well, he's no longer embedded because basically the journalists are now running Buck Willie through Iraq. Our own journalist, Michael Mayburn, who was with the 3rd Regimented Armored Division, and I guess is now pretty much just sort of freelancing, driving around Iraq in a Toyota Hilux. I believe that's the vehicle of choice in Iraq. And we have a feed from Michael. He is just a few miles outside of Baghdad near one of the bridges that has just been secured. And let's see if we can get that feed up and online. Michael, are you there?
Amanda.
Michael?
What?
Why are you singing Amanda?
I don't know. It just seemed like the thing to chant at the time. Sorry. I'm supposed to remain objective.
But
should get caught up in anything.
But South Africa is at least like 7,000 miles away from where you are. You were singing.
I wasn't there for that when that went down, and I wish I could have been there for that instead of this thing.
So I mean, there was no Arabic or Pashto equivalent to Amandla?
I didn't do the language thing. They promised me I'd get translators. So, wait, let me do my official journalistic intro. This is correspondent Michael Mayburn reporting live. I'm about 6 miles outside the capital in Iraq, Baghdad. I'm standing in a town populated by all children, Yusuf.
Just children?
Children. Freedom-loving Iraqi children who are symbolically tearing down a statue of Saddam Hussein.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to it here live on the Creative Unity Collective pseudo-news, this special war update escape for the battle beneath the conquest of the planet of Saddam, where Michael Mayburn, our one-time embedded reporter, is reporting to us that 6 miles outside of Baghdad, he is witnessing the tearing down of yet another Saddam Hussein statue. I wish we had video on this.
Well, not for nothing, but it's not really that photogenic.
It is photogenic. Whenever an oppressed people tear down a statue of the horrible tyrant that has oppressed them for 3 decades, it's a big deal, Michael. Why aren't you more excited about this?
This statue is only like 3 feet tall. 3 feet tall total.
Michael, are you getting a Children of the Corn vibe? Yeah, they're just playing.
You see
really,
Malachi around, a redhead?
Actually, they were just sort of like playing a handball against this thing, and it just sort of started to crack. So you know how kids are. You know, once they sort of break something, they get off on the fact that they broke something. But it's still a symbol of freedom and democracy.
Is this in the suburbs?
Yeah.
Are you sure this isn't like a little lawn jockey and not actually a statue of Saddam?
It looks like him to me.
Is it holding a lantern?
It is, but it's Saddam.
I suggest you get...
Lawn jockey.
He put up statues of himself all around this country, Yusuf.
The
kids are tearing it down as an act of defiance.
It doesn't sound very loud. I don't hear heavy earth-moving equipment. Why don't I hear heavy earth-moving equipment? Is there a flag being draped on its face?
No, they put a SpongeBob SquarePants shirt on it.
They have that?
Yeah, they have that. Oh, they got messed up. Let me just tell you, Yusuf. Looting is taking place in Baghdad like you wouldn't believe.
What did they loot? The Baghdad Old Navy?
Oh, you think there isn't an Old Navy in Baghdad? Yeah. Surely you underestimate the power of American capitalism.
Yo, they put that there with the quickness.
And irony is dead.
There's a store that sells throwback jerseys in the capital. Oh, needless to say, the freedom-loving Iraqis will be hooked up repping the old school.
Yo, Michael.
There's a dude running around with an Alex English jersey, all right?
Yo, I can't
Michael,
even get that here.
Real.
Michael.
Yes.
How much are they going for over there?
Yeah, could you get me a couple?
Right now, the price is right.
If you can get me a Reggie Theus number 24 at Kansas City Kings for like under $100,
well,
we got a deal.
As a formerly embedded pseudo-journalist, I'm not allowed to do the old five-figure discount with throwback jerseys.
I might be able
to get you a DVD player. They're just sort of like laying in the street.
Well, all right, above and beyond this, the kids are tearing down this statue.
Yes.
What sort of tools are they using to do this?
Basically, these kids just sort of came out of the gymboree, sort of playing handball with a Spalding, and they knocked over the Saddam statue. It's three feet tall, usually.
What is the statue made out of, Michael?
I think Play-Doh.
Are they...
But the material of the statue does not in any way diminish the symbolic imagery and iconography of freedom and democracy that the tearing down of the statue symbolizes. Sorry.
Do the children look happy? Do they look gleeful? Do they look happy to no longer be oppressed?
Dude, they're children.
Well, the kid that put his SpongeBob t-shirt on it seems happy.
Oh.
They're playing like G.I. Joe with
it. Are they dragging it through the streets?
There's a girl here that's got like a brat style that's bigger than this thing.
I don't hear much celebration.
Well, you know, they had to go home. It's late.
Michael, any leads on WOMDs?
Weapons of mass destruction.
Michael, a slingshot, a pea shooter, an air zip gun, anything?
It's a they got a number 7 Spalding they were playing handball with. I mean, those things can be pretty hard. But aside from that, I got nothing.
Well, we thank you, Michael, for that poignant report. And please feel free to call us back with another report. Just make sure it's a bigger statue.
Yeah, this has been the Creative Unity Pseudo News.
Statue go boom!
The Creative Unity Collective. Special thanks to T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet for providing that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey, and our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hamid of KPFA, Sidrak Franklin, Keith Shaljian, and Benta Berklin. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.